I did mention, albeit in passing this morning, that we would be taking a detailed look at 2 Timothy chapter 2 and looking at some of the terms that Paul used to describe Timothy and the child of God. And I'm sure that some of you picked up on that and probably spent this afternoon studying that chapter. In fact, I'm just almost afraid you studied it more than I did this afternoon. But I know that now some of you didn't catch what I said as I was saying it in passing. I'm sure. And so, if you missed that and didn't have the knowledge to use that opportunity to study this passage this afternoon, we're going to give you a pass on that. Tonight, I want us to together open up our Bibles to 2 Timothy chapter 2. There are some terms that I would like for us to look at. You know, the Bible uses objects as illustrations again and again and again. In fact, one of the more common ways that the Bible teaches us, particularly in the New Testament and particularly during Jesus' ministry, Jesus used things, sometimes animate, sometimes inanimate, to illustrate important principles. Jesus often said, "The kingdom of heaven is like unto so-and-so." In fact, Jesus used a lot of the inanimate objects to illustrate the principles and the points that he was making. He used the treasure. He used the precious pearls. He used the coin. He used the fig tree and the mustard seed and the tower. And on we could go, recalling those inanimate objects. I think inanimate means not living. To illustrate principles that he was teaching. And then, of course, Jesus also used a lot of animate objects or living things. He illustrated some really important lessons with things like the lost son, the lost sheep. Jesus illustrated some really important principles with things like the friend at midnight, the king who was going forth into battle against his enemy, the servants or the hired men who would be working in a man's vineyard. All of those things Jesus used to teach very important lessons. There are seven objects in 2 Timothy chapter 2 that the Apostle Paul uses to call Timothy's attention, and by extension, ours as well, to some really important principles. And I'd like for us just to begin and go through this chapter and observe those seven things. Not a great deal we're going to say on any one of them, but hopefully they will be tools in our minds to trigger some really important thoughts concerning God's will. We got our introduction to Timothy in the book of Acts as Paul went to a certain place and there was a young man who was a disciple. I believe it's chapter 14, 15, somewhere along in there, 16. And in this place, there was this young man, Timothy, whose mother was faithful and whose grandmother was faithful and who was very highly spoken of. And the Bible begins at that point and includes Timothy in Paul's missionary journeys. And throughout the rest of the book of Acts, we see Timothy rising and being present in certain occasions. And it appears that Timothy has been in Ephesus. And this is the second letter that Paul will write to Timothy. The first one was written a few years prior to this. Paul writes this letter while he's in prison in Rome awaiting his execution. And as he writes these things to Timothy, we get a view into Paul's heart. We see some really somber things, but we see that even in a situation where Paul was waiting for his own execution, Paul's heart was 100% for serving God. And so he writes to Timothy, and beginning in chapter 2, verse 1, he says, "You then, my son, my child." It's in the first verse or two of both 1 Timothy and 2 Timothy that Paul refers to Timothy as his son, his child, his son in the faith. And it may very well be that Paul had been instrumental in converting Timothy. At any rate, there was a tremendously precious relationship between these two. And now, as he nears the end of his life, he addresses Timothy once again for the second time in this letter as my child. Now, without regard to a lot of other things that could be included in this point, there is the fact that this relationship existed between the Apostle Paul and the disciple Timothy. And if you have ever had an older person to help you and coach you and mentor you and lead you throughout various stages of your spiritual journey on this earth, you are blessed immeasurably. I have had a number of those kind of people in my life, and they were very precious to me. Some of them were very close to me. Some of them blood relatives. Some of them dear friends. But all of them, I would have to say, were people who led me in the faith. People that I could look up to. People that I trusted to steer me in the right direction. I cannot tell you how many times as a young gospel preacher I would go to Brother Kenneth Randolph's house and knock on his door and go into his study and just pour out my heart about some particular issue or some particular problem in the church or in a congregation where I was preaching at that time. And he, I remember well as one who was always anxious to help. And I remember him as one of my Apostle Pauls. My father, of course, was one upon whom I relied very heavily. And with due respect and certainly deep regard for those of you who were never fortunate enough to have someone in your life who was of such spiritual strength that you could turn to them and that they would help lead you through those difficult times, what a wonderful experience it was to be able to lean heavily upon those people in my life and to still have those to whom I can go to on such occasions. Paul and Timothy had that relationship. Now, where's the lesson for us other than the fact that we've got a lot to be thankful for? We've got some precious people around us and in our lives. Let's focus on this lesson. Who could you be an Apostle Paul for? No, we'd never, any of us, ever be the Apostle Paul, but who could you be that kind of leader for? Who could you be that kind of encouragement for? Surely there are people all around each of us, young people who perhaps are making their way through some of life's hard knocks, people who would certainly, perhaps sometimes without even realizing their need, would be open to our help and our encouragement. Look around and find those people that you can help to lead as Paul led his child, his son in the faith, Timothy. Down in verse 3, we find the second term. He says, share in suffering as a, as a good soldier of Christ Jesus. A good soldier. To the church in Ephesus, Paul gave a rather detailed bit of instruction regarding the warfare that we as Christians are engaged in, and even made reference to that spiritual armor that we all wear. And here he reminds Timothy of the importance of taking on the traits of a good soldier as he fights the fight of faith. Later on in this same letter, Paul would remind Timothy, I have fought a good fight. In fact, a number of times in Paul's writings, we see the imagery of the soldier along with the warfare, the battle that we're doing. Don't ever consider it less than a battle. A battle for the salvation of souls, a war for the sake of saving people. You know, there are a lot of good causes today. There are a lot of important causes. There are a lot of causes that people get caught up in that, well, I don't think they're all that important, and they tend to kind of muddle things up and get in the way of some other important issues. I was talking to a lady just yesterday, and she was talking the terrible, horrible, unspeakable tragedy of when those evil men on those horrible tractors and bush hogs go through the tall grass, and every now and then, heaven forbid, at least to her, they run over a little fawn or a young animal that's lying there bedded down in the grass. And I could see in her mind she was putting together, or maybe some other person was leading her into trying to put together a plan that the next time they bush hog that big field near her house, they were all going to join hands and walk through there and rescue those animals. And I, this whole time I'm thinking, isn't there something that ought to be a little bit more urgent for you to give some time to and some effort to? You know, the world doesn't lack for causes that people are just really consumed with. There is no greater cause than the cause of salvation and the fight against the forces, the influence, and the results of sin. Fight the good fight. And Paul says, remember, you're a soldier of the Lord Jesus Christ, and a soldier doesn't get tangled up in things that might distract him from his mission. And he has one aim, and that is to please his commander. The lessons there for us are obvious, aren't they? Number 3, I see the word athlete. In verse 5, an athlete is not crowned unless he competes according to the rules. Now, you know, this is a little bit different lesson from the one that Paul taught to the Corinthians in 1 Corinthians chapter 9. Paul used the athlete as an illustration several times. And in 1 Corinthians chapter 9, his point was, without self-control, the athlete cannot compete. And we need that self-control. Here, his point is, unless the athlete follows the rules, he cannot win. Follows the rules. Now, I'm here to tell you, there are some folks, and folks who claim to be really religious people, who just get their hackles up at that very phrase, follow the rules, when you're talking about spiritual things, because we've somehow gotten the idea that there shouldn't have to be any rules to follow. There shouldn't have to be any commandments to keep. But there are. And Paul makes it clear here. An athlete is not crowned unless he competes according to the rules. We've been studying and discussing for a few weeks now on Sunday morning and also in a few lessons on Sunday night, the state of the northern kingdom of Israel and the fact that they had rejected God's commands and refused to follow God's rules, and the results were obvious, that they were hurting no one else but themselves. We're in a race. We're in a competition, so to speak. But unless we follow the rules, we cannot win. In the fourth place, he says in verse 6, it is the hardworking farmer. It is the hardworking farmer who ought to have the first share of the crops. Now, I don't mind telling you there's a little bit of controversy around this verse because it seems, and I'm certainly not an expert in any of the ancient languages, especially like Jimmy is, but the commentators, that even some of the oldest and ones that go back the farthest, are all at odds over the arrangement of the words in this sentence, and it appears that perhaps the point of this verse ought to be expressed in this way. The hardworking farmer has the first share of the crops, or the farmer has the first share of the crops only after he works hard. In other words, in the same way that there cannot be a winner in the competition who doesn't follow the rules, there cannot be a successful farmer who eats the produce unless he works hard for it. That would seem to follow, wouldn't it, Doug? A farmer has a hard job. And a farmer who isn't willing to work hard is going to have some bad years. He might get lucky every now and then. But it's usually through hard work that he produces a crop. So it would be true of us. The only way we'll enjoy the heavenly reward is through hard work and following the Lord's commands. Now, for number five, we can skip down to that verse that we talked about this morning, where Paul says, do your best to present yourself to God as one approved, a worker. A worker who does not need to be ashamed, rightly handling the word of truth. Remember, we said this morning that there are some really important terms in that verse. Approved unto God doesn't mean rubber stamped, but it means something or someone that has been tested and proven to be correct. And this approval, this proving in this context, is something that is ongoing, that must be done over and over and over. Prove yourself to be an approved workman. Now, we also said that that word worker is very important. It is from that word that we have that song that we sang at the beginning of our service. To the work, we are servants of God. The chorus says, toiling on, toiling on. The literal definition of the worker here in verse 15 is a toiler. Now, the sixth word that Paul uses to illustrate what we should be is down there in verse 20. Now, in a great house, there are not only vessels of gold and silver, but also of wood and clay, some for honorable use, some for dishonorable. Now, I got to tell you, there's a lot wrapped up into this terminology. In every house, Paul says, there are different kinds of vessels. Honorable use would have to do with that which, well, just this past week, my mother sent out an email to all of us and our children and so forth. Mom's cleaning out the house, getting ready to move down here, and so there's a lot of stuff that's got to be gotten rid of. And so she sends out an email, and I got to tell you this one other thing too. My grandmother, my dad's mother, was referred to by her only grandson, that was me, from the time I could just barely speak. Her name was Mulhoney. Mulhoney. My dad always referred to his mother as Maul and his daddy as Paul. Now, they weren't necessarily hillbillies from Arkansas or somewhere, but my grandmother was always Maul and my granddaddy was always Paul. And so they say whenever we would come for a visit, and we lived a long way away, and so we only saw them a few times a year, they say that whenever I would get out of the car, she would pick me up and hug me and say, "There's my honey." And from that, they surmise that I got the name Mulhoney, and that's what I called my grandmother until she passed away. Anyway, the point is, Mother sent out an email to all of us one day last week, and she said, "Does anybody want Mulhoney's Sunday dishes?" Now, some of you older ladies know what your Sunday dishes were. They were the ones that you didn't use every day, but rather the ones that you set the table with on Sunday when the preacher came to eat lunch after morning worship services. Anyway, there were Mulhoney's, and nobody wanted them. And so Beth and I said, "Sure, we'll take them." You know, sentimentality runs really thick and deep in me. But anyway, we knew what Mulhoney's Sunday dishes were. They were vessels of honor. They were not paper plates. They were not the old feed store cups that had the feed emblem on the side of them. They were not the plates that looked like they'd been picked up out of the yard after they'd been scrubbed with sand. They were something a little bit nicer. They were vessels of honor. The vessels of dishonor in a house would be pretty much everything else, stuff that was for, as we say, everyday use, common use. Dishonor is not a derogatory term in this case, but it just distinguishes between that which is fancy and that which is not. And so Paul says in every house there are vessels of honor, vessels of dishonor. I remember when Paul talked about the potter and the clay. Remember, he said it's all up to the potter whether he makes out of the lump a vessel of honor or out of the same lump a vessel of dishonor. For two entirely different purposes. I believe there are two points here in this particular context. First of all, not all vessels are the same. Not all church members are the same. Not all people have the same abilities. Not all of us have the same talents. Not all of us respond in the same way to certain appeals. We're individuals. God made us that way, and God honors us that way as long as we stay within the boundaries of His will. And so in any house, there are vessels of honor and vessels of dishonor, and every single one of us can't do everything that everybody does. 1 Corinthians chapter 12, Paul goes into that same point with the church at Corinth regarding their spiritual gifts. He says everybody can't do everything. Everybody's not a hand. Everybody's not a foot. Everybody's not an eye or an ear. But all of the hands and feet and legs and ears and eyes and everything work together so that the body is functional. I think that's the first point here when he says there are vessels. But there is a separate point, I believe, and totally unrelated to the fact that we're different, is the fact that indeed some are good and some are bad. And notice what he says. Therefore, verse 21, if anyone cleanses himself from what is dishonorable, and the dishonorable here would be a derogatory term. If anybody will cleanse himself from what is dishonorable, he will be a vessel for honorable use, set apart as holy. And here's the heart of the matter right here. Useful to the master of the house, ready for every good work. Let's make sure that those words describe us. Ready for every good work. And then there's one other term. Number 7, there at verse 24. And the Lord's servant. The Lord's servant must not be quarrelsome. Your translation may say, must not strive. But be kind to everyone, able to teach, patiently enduring evil, correcting his opponents with gentleness. Now, all of my Christian life, I've heard the debate about whether this verse is referring to elders as the Lord's servants, whether it's referring to the gospel preacher as the servant of the Lord. For the sake of our study tonight, let's not get caught up in that debate, but let's look carefully at what he says the servant of the Lord must be. Not quarrelsome. Now, which Christian is it that it's okay to be quarrelsome? I don't think there's one either, John. I don't think that there's any such thing as a child of God that God says, okay, you, I'm not worried about. If you want to be quarrelsome, you go ahead. No, that's not it. And so there's not a single one of us who does not need to make sure we put away a quarrelsome spirit or attitude. The Lord's servant must be kind to everyone. There are plenty of passages elsewhere in the New Testament that place the responsibility for kindness squarely on the shoulders of every single child of God. And so, again, the old question, well, which Christian is it that doesn't have to be kind? Well, there's not one. Able to teach. I guess this is where we get hung up in the elder question. But isn't the daily influence of being salt of the earth and light of the world, in a sense, a form of teaching? And what Christian is it that shouldn't give proper attention to being the right kind of example, and as Derek prayed this morning, leader in some sense? Patient. Anybody exempt from being patient? No, not according to James's little letter. Enduring evil. Again, we could go to many places in the New Testament and see that God expects His people to endure evil here on this earth. We're not exempt from being the recipients of bad things. Bad things do happen to good people. With gentleness, correcting their opponents. Our opponents, in the general sense, would be those who are opposed to God. And how would we be able to convince them to change their heart without, at least in the general sense, being gentle with our approach and our presentation of the truth. And so, I think that term servant there is one of the big ones. The servant of the Lord. And the question remains for all of us. Am I a servant of the Lord? Not am I an elder, not am I a preacher, but am I a servant of the Lord in the sense that God expects us to serve Him and put Him first every day of our lives? I wouldn't want to press you into a study of the entire New Testament in this way, but I think this is an interesting way to look at this particular chapter anyway, that has a number of terms in it that hold some really important spiritual lessons for us. Are you a child of God? Have you obeyed the gospel? If not, why not do it tonight? If you have obeyed the gospel but have become unfaithful, why not come back and be restored? You're subject to our Lord's invitation in any way. We invite you to respond as we stand together and sing this song.